I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everybody. Today, my guest is Christy Lauren Adams. She is a speaker, an author, an advocate, and a minister. She is ordained with the American Baptist Churches USA and currently the associate pastor of First Baptist Church of Lincoln Gardens in Somerset, New Jersey. She's also the founder and director of Becoming, an annual conference designed to empower, educate, and inspire girls between the ages of 12 and 16. Thank you so much, Christy, for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me.
I was really inspired by a lot of the things on your website. You've written a book, you've done short films, you do, of course, speaking and preaching, and there were clips, and I was not even sure what to start talking about.
Right.
But I first thought it might be neat to go into a little bit of your spiritual or religious background in childhood and how that was influential for you.
Yeah. So I was thinking about this because I did hear your last podcast and the one you sent me in, and that was the first question. I said, wow, how can I reflect on that if she asked me? And I just started thinking a lot about how I grew up and how my parents were so intentional about putting myself, my sister — I have a younger sister, older brother — about putting our spiritual growth and spiritual formation as like a priority, making sure that they intentionally surrounded us with a faith community. Mm-hmm. That was the priority. We moved from Brooklyn, New York, to New Jersey when I was like in the second grade. Mm-hmm. I have some early memories in New York of being kind of in church here and there. But when we got here, I just remember after being here a year, it was a real mission for my family to find, a strong spiritual community, particularly for us, so that we can grow. And just so happened, to find one not too far away, probably about 20, 25 minutes from where I grew up. And that's where I'm working today, actually. That is where I'm serving, at least as one of the associate pastors at First Baptist Church. So I've kind of come full circle. But it just had such an effect on me growing up, being a part of that community. I wouldn't say that, I feel like it was really instrumental in forming my faith. But there was a part of my life where I had to take responsibility and accountability for my own faith. It wasn't just my parents driving me to church or whatever. And honestly, for me, I think that was planted. Those seeds were planted when I was kind of growing up in those spaces. But it really wasn't until I got to college that, it became like a real thing, where I started asking some of those deeper questions like, well, what's my meaning? What's my purpose? Which is, I think, why I've been attracted to campus ministry in the recent years of my life, as far as my vocation, because I felt like personally, that is where I started asking those questions. And that's where a lot of students ask, questions about their vocation and their faith and their purpose. And so anyway, so that's kind of how it started for me.
Right. So it's true, when you're a young adult, you get to decide, I can sleep in, or I can go to church, I can make different sorts of friends, and they can, be people that my parents would hate me to have friendships with, or they could be people that I think will bring out the best in me. And now you're able to influence through some of your ministries, some of these age groups. And it is remarkable that you've came full circle, because you've kind of been all over the place.
Yeah.
So I know you went to Temple. You stayed a little bit close to home to go to undergrad. And then what happened on the way? You start out in advertising, which is actually what I studied as well. I went to Kutztown and I studied what's called communication design. So it was like kind of the graphic design end of that. But and then all of a sudden, what happened?
Yeah. So I always tell everybody I was an advertising major, because when I was in high school, I watched some movie with Jennifer Aniston or something, and she was like an ad exec, and it just looked like a lot of fun. So I just said, I'll pick that as a major. And I wanted to nurture the creative. There was a creative side that I feel like I had that could fit well with advertising. And so I stuck with that major. I didn't change My mom was like really against switching majors a bunch of times, and I knew that in the back of my head. So any exploring I did was in the realm of taking electives. Mm-hmm. So so while I was in college, I stayed the advertising major, but my interests in, you know, like I said, faith formation, even theater, I started taking those types of electives, you know. And then when I was in college, myself, my roommates, we started a campus ministry, and it was mainly for performing arts, but also, you know, we did some Bible studies amongst one another and prayer groups, and we didn't know what we were doing, but it was a place that we could live that out, live out our faith. I was in the gospel choir. So all those things were being formed while I was an advertising major, so that by the time I graduated, I was like, you know, I really want to take this further. I want to do ministry, but I always said I didn't want to do anything formal. You know, I never want to be Reverend Adams, which I am now. I never want to wear a robe, which I have to wear now, you know, for Sunday. So so those were things I was like adamantly against, but I wanted to learn more and study more. So that kind of started that journey for me. So that's kind of like the really quick version. And I kind of stayed in New Jersey, I will say. You know, I went back and worked at my church's nonprofit as a youth specialist for a few years. And then I was still working, even though I was working at the nonprofit, I was still, you know, closely associated with working with the youth in the church. So it was ministry to me. And it really wasn't long after I worked there that I said, you know what, I'm going to, you know, try to go to seminary. And that's where that started.
Yeah. So you went to seminary at Princeton, and did you have a focus while you were there, something specific that you were drilling down into?
They didn't have, like, official focus outside of just normal MDiv, but there were classes that I took that all had the same kind of theme. Mm-hmm. My classes were really more justice-oriented. I took a lot of, like, religious radical-type classes, mm-hmm. you know. And in that kind of practical theology route, I took, that was when I took my first feminist class. It was a class called Feminist Womanist that I fell in love with. Mm. So I kind of stayed with those types of courses when I was there. Mm-hmm. And you know, after it was three intense years, and this is, you know, all due respect to anybody that goes to Princeton Seminary now, they have 72 credits that they can graduate. I had to graduate. We had to graduate with 90. So yeah. Around the time where we were like still in that, you know, you're being hazed type, you know, season. So it was crazy, but it was a really enriching experience. It was challenging personally on a bunch of levels, but it was also really enriching, and it completely changed my life. So I still didn't know what I wanted to do after when I graduated, but I feel like I was one step closer, you know.
And then where does Georgetown fit into the timeline?
Georgetown. Oof, that was, I didn't get to Georgetown because I was in Los Angeles for a while, at Azusa Pacific University, another life-changing experience for me. Leaving APU was really, really difficult, because I just got so close with everybody there, and I get choked up talking about them now. Mm-hmm. So, but I came back to the East Coast to be closer to my family and my friends. And so the decision to go to Georgetown came during that decision to leave APU. My friend, who was a colleague, Jessie, she was a colleague of mine at Princeton, who I was very close with. And she just happened to have been at the time a chaplain in residence at Georgetown. And so when she heard that I was thinking about moving back to the East, she said, look, you can still do campus ministry. You know, here's an opportunity here at Georgetown. You know, I'm here. I can, you know, connect you to the right people. So I applied to a chaplain in residence position in Georgetown, and they accepted me and waited really for me to come and finish up at APU, because it took like, it almost took a year for me to transition out of APU, because it was we had to be really sensitive. It was a public position. I was the, you know, the only Black woman in that type of role, especially pastorally, and it was a preaching role, and you know, all of that. And so we didn't want to just pull the plug. So during that transition, I was waiting to go to Georgetown as a chaplain in residence. And while I was at Georgetown, it was weird. The chaplain in residence program there is fantastic, actually. They have a chaplain residence in every single dorm. But I didn't have any other job. It was like a few months into being there that I landed the other role, the Protestant chaplain role, at the law center and at the university. So within like 6 months of being there, I had like three different roles on
wow.
campus. It was a blessing, you know, but it was a lot of responsibility that came out of nowhere where I was like, I didn't have a job, you know, a few months ago. And now all of a sudden I'm, you know, I have three here Whoa. On the campus. And so, yeah, that was what happened to that.
Oh, my goodness. And then, well, okay, so then how long were you there?
I wasn't there long. It was an interim role. Mm-hmm. I got there probably January 2015 and then left around May, June 2016. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't too long. It seems like it was long to me only because I was living with 400 freshmen and had the different roles. So I was there 24 hours a day.
Wow.
Which was like the equivalent of 4 years to me. But yeah, that was also tough. I was really close with them. That was also a tough decision to leave. It was financially, it was just really hard, you know, just for transparency's sake, it was just hard to live in the DMV. Mm-hmm. Anybody that lives in DC knows how hard it is to live out there financially. Mm-hmm. So I just had to make a decision, you know, it was really, I was starting to get burnt out. Mm-hmm. You know, from being there a lot, and in order for me to, it was either be burnt out or try to find a place, you know, and not know if I can afford a place, you know, so
yeah,
it was that decision that you have to make as a single woman. Mm-hmm. and I had talked to my pastor back home, and that's where the full circle comes in. You know, he's like, that we're going to need some help with, you know, he's going to be transitioning from his role as pastor, probably, who knows, you know, but in the future at some point. And the church is transitioning leadership as far as, you know, some of the older leadership or the leadership that was there when I was eight, when I, you know, mm-hmm. when my family joined, is now getting older and they're looking to retire and move on. So mm-hmm. him and I had a conversation about that. And so I just felt like it would be, you know, beneficial for me to come and just be present, even in a minimal level, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, is your church and denomination receptive to female pastors, or was that like a hurdle to jump or anything
yeah,
like that?
You know what's crazy? I didn't know, you know, the whole female pastor thing was a problem until later.
Oh,
so, it was not a thing growing up. And, you know, it's so funny telling people that story. I don't, you know how you share something or people, you know, you want to be a part of the struggle, you know, and I'm like, I wasn't a part of it, you know, like, not until later. It wasn't even until I got to seminary that we started having those conversations. Mm. So my, we always had women pastors. I never even considered. And it's interesting for me because it was a normative experience for me, you know? And, I feel like if anybody did like, can do an experiment on, you know, what would it be for it to just be normative and you don't have any other options. There's, you know, you're not considering anything else. And so our executive pastor was a woman. Mm. There would be times where, you know, cause my church was, a little traditional, mm-hmm. You know, not a little, actually, just a traditional Black Baptist church, mm-hmm. but we had women pastors. And so I remember growing up, there would be times where she, you know, would lead us in the hymn. Mm-hmm. And you know how the hymns have like, you know, the pronoun for God is he, you know, mm-hmm. and she would like switch it on out, like, you know, put she in there. And everybody would cringe, you know, everybody would sing along, you know, and they wouldn't say anything behind her back. But, you know, everybody, and I would look around like, ooh, she's in trouble, you know, like that was the extent of any gender related, you know, issues or complications was for me was when those things were switched out. But always had women pastors, women. I grew up with women in the pulpit preaching in robes, and it just never crossed my mind until later when somebody brought it up that it was a problem outside of the space. So I was pretty protected.
It really is interesting because, you know, I came from the complete opposite. It was like, you know, your job is to submit to a man, your father or your husband, don't say a word. And mm-hmm. and so it was really like, I had like personhood envy, you know. I was a kid realizing like, oh man, this sucks. Like I was born on the wrong, like I was born into like the sucky role, you know. Okay. And I was like, but I remember feeling like immediately understanding, even before there was even a little bit of explanation about anything. I was like, oh, I get it. There's like regular people, and then there's women. And just realizing what a big step down it was. But of course, you were supposed to be honored by it. That is amazing. And then maybe to be in different contexts where, you know, you've come from this background, but then in different contexts where you are, you might be put back down into, wait a minute, are you allowed to be here? You know
what's crazy? It's like, you know, once somebody points out, it's kind of like, you know, those experiments with kids, right? With skin color, you know, and then it's like, it eventually gets pointed out and then it becomes an issue, you know? Once it got pointed out, you know, it started to be more of an issue. And then the insecurity, it was almost like I started off with a certain level of confidence. And then the more kind of it was talked about, or you're in spaces where, you know, they're trying to, you know, silence you or, you know, debate your call, all of that, then it kind of like you revert. I had to be built back up.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. In this kind of weird way. I remember getting to APU and I was ordained 1 week before I moved to California. And I was ordained at my church that I'm at now, and my denomination. And I just remember getting to APU and being there the first year and really never calling myself pastor or anything. You know, pastor to me was always a senior pastor at a church, and that's kind of it. But I was kind of insecure about calling myself pastor, and my boss, Woody, would just be like, you're a pastor, call yourself pastor. Like he had to say it over and over again to me, you know, for it to start to resonate, for me to be like, I am Pastor Christie, you know, it doesn't make me cringe anymore to say it. But had I not, you know, had those years of, you know, being questioned for it outside of the space that I grew up in, you know, it never would have been an issue, but I had to kind of take some back steps and then be encouraged in it again. You know, it was weird.
Yeah. It's like a new finding your identity in a different context. To know, yeah, this is me. This is me in different contexts and different, you know, whether I'm getting questioned or not, I know who I am. And it is really interesting though, because depending on how you're treated by a group who may or may not have some kind of say so, then you wind up asking yourself, well, gosh, you know, do I need to look something up, or do I deserve to be here? It's really strange. I wanted to talk to you about becoming and how this came about, this conference and your work with this age group.
So since I've been back home, my mom's best friend is a clinical director of a counseling center not far from here, actually not far from my church, called Christian Wellness Center. And so she said, look, I know you've worked with, you know, college students and teenagers and young girls, you know, would love your help if you can come out. And so I'm there part-time as a pastoral counselor. And so I would get this influx of girls that, you know, whether they're coming in on their own because they ask their parents if they can come in, or whether they're young adults or college students that want to come, or who are just being dragged in by their moms, particularly their moms, just don't know what to do, you know. And most of these girls are young girls of color, actually the 99% of them, right? And so my schedule started to be full of them, and it didn't matter what their background was, whether their socioeconomic background or what type of family, whether they come from a family that, you know, the parents are still married or they're divorced, never been married, whatever. They all had very similar issues. And so I'm like, well, I'm not full time. You know, I could only take but so many. And there's another counselor there that does work with young girls too. And So we were just talking, myself and the clinical director, Miss Welcome, and I said, you know, I feel like we should do something for girls, you know, and mainly young girls of color, just have a conference that is just devoted to them, a space for them. And originally it was supposed to be something that was just really small. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had just done a conference for my pastor, helped him with one of his conferences for one of his nonprofits, and said, you know, I'm in this mode of planning conferences, so why not just do something for these girls? And then we came up with the name Becoming, and it was like last year in February that we had this conversation, and we started it in March, you know, planning for something in June.
Wow.
Originally just like, oh, maybe we'll have maybe 25 to 50 girls, and it wound up being 115 or something like that. And it just, one thing led to another. A friend of mine who's the CEO of Campaign for Black Male Achievement said, look, we want to sponsor the conference, you know, heard that I was trying to do something. Another woman who works at Rutgers who knows Miss Welcome, you know, said, hey, there's a space here, an auditorium and some rooms that are available, you know, we can hook you up. So just those things started happening. And I just, you know, we put it out, and I got some of my friends together and my sister and her friends, mainly younger. I wanted younger girls to be speaking into the girls' lives. Mm-hmm. And just created Becoming. And all of a sudden it sold out because we can only fit 100 in the room.
Wow.
And so we had about 110, 115. We got t-shirts. My nephew came up from South Carolina, and he's a DJ. And my niece, she's like a rapper. She's 13, 14 actually. And so she rapped, and it was just really cute. We had, you know, different workshops, and we talked about all of the topics that came up in my counseling sessions. I felt like, you know, we needed to address, watch some films, and some of my friends have their own businesses, hair care. My friend Lauren has a hair care company called Purely Perfect Hair. And so she came and creates natural hair products for, you know, for people, not just young women. So she came and had a table. And so there were different people that were there that just wanted to support. And it just turned into this really great thing, you know.
Wow.
So we wanted to continue to have that every year just to create a space. And so we're trying to do it this year. I just found out that our venue is under renovations, the one that we used last year. So I'm like, oh, okay, God, all right, like, make a way. So that's where we're at now.
Well, maybe it'll be a way that includes the ability to have more people come.
Yeah, hopefully.
So what are some of the main things that you notice that these young women struggle with?
Yeah, so typical things that you would, you know, assume, like identity issues. Mm-hmm. I think when you say identity, it's so broad because, you know, every generation, I think it means something different. And so when, you know, with my generation, I guess when I was a teenager, like in the 90s, you say identity, it means something different than, you know, for these young women who I didn't live online, you know, we didn't have online. God, when I was 13 years old. So living out identity formation in an online world, in a world where reality television kind of rules the world, at least their world, it's really difficult. And so definitely that, you know, a lot of them have a hard time. They don't even know they have a voice. You know, they don't think they have any opinions, even if they have great families, you know. They don't know how to use their voice. And that's a big deal to me. That's something I really want to look into a little bit more. I want to write about it some more. I'm trying to show them how to use their everyday voices, how to say, hey, mom, can I talk to you about this? You know, or how to raise your hand in class, or how to, you know, have an opinion. A lot of times their voice winds up coming out, and there's nothing wrong with anger, which I tell them all, but it's coming out in these kind of unhealthy ways. And so I'm trying to use them how to use their voice in a healthy way, but also in a way that's consistent. And so I, you know, my theory is that once they start learning how to use their voice in these everyday spaces, then when they get out, you know, then we can start talking to them about leadership, you know, being a leader or being a preacher or whatever it is that, you know, might be another level for them. But I think they need to try to learn how to master it now. And I talked to my sister's 23. And I talk to her a lot about that now. You know, I say, you know, it's one thing to go off on somebody in a text message. It's another thing to, you know, when you're in the moment, learn how to address, you know, because sometimes something will happen and she'll, you know not how to react and just kind of leave it alone. And then later on go, you know, go off or do whatever, you know? So I'm like, okay, let's learn how to, in the moment, if something, how do you address it then? You know? So that's what I try to teach these girls just on a basic level. But, you know, their family systems are all kind of unique and they're just struggling. They don't have a safe space where they could be vulnerable, where they aren't judged, you know, where they can just be who they are without having to perform. And so I try to just, whether it's a half hour or an hour when we're in a session, to try to create an environment for them where they can, you know, just be. One girl came in last week and she was like, I did something I don't even know how to tell you. And I'm like, listen, whatever you did, I do not think I still think you're a wonderful person. It's not going to make me think that you're a horrible human being. So let's just start there.
Right. Yeah, we were talking a little bit before I started recording about the slow work of building relationships, truly engaged relationships that aren't superficial, where you can talk about hard things and, you know, you be encouraging, but also talk about the uglier parts that are hard to and maybe feel shameful to speak of, and just how you have to put in such an investment of yourself into those relationships, but they actually really reap something. But it's kind of these, you know, behind the closed door, because, you know, these are not the spotlight relationships. These are supposed to be private and they're very nurturing. And we're talking about that too. And being drawn into those types of ministries is really God's work. It's really the kind of work that makes the difference in people's lives. And I think as you were talking about that to me and seeing, wow, I see patterns. I see that this is not like one or two people struggling here. This is like a whole generation of people with some serious stuff going on.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing I'm seeing is that, you know, I'm sure there are churches that are doing the hard work, but the bulk of the work does not take place in the pulpit. And I think like we're forgetting that, you know, like, it doesn't, that the pulpit is such a small percentage. You know, I thank God for the word that's delivered on Sunday or whatever day of the week it is, but we're centering that, you know? And the hard work really takes place in the building of these relationships. And it can't be done by one solo person, you know? It takes a community. Takes a village to raise a child, you know? It really takes a community to invest, and it's not glamorous, and, you know, it's not on camera, and it takes a while, you know? I remember, like, somebody asked me what was the best part of my experience at APU that I can say when it's come deals with the students, and I'm like, I had a lot of upfront moments at APU, but the best part was I can think of one girl that I worked with for 4 years, you know, like hard work of her coming into my office for 4 years and just to watch her graduate and to see how far she had come and how much work, you know, we had just put into just having coffee and having conversations and nobody saw.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That blessed me the most. That was the best part of my experience, was watching her graduate and just seeing how, you know, how far she had come emotionally and as a young woman. Mm-hmm. And that's the best part. And I think that's the part that God sees the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, it's true. I have a daughter who's 15 and I try to have conversations with her. She's fairly open. I mean, far more open than I was at 15. Let me tell you that, with my mom. And I think it is an interesting thing how technology, just always having a smartphone in your hand. And then there's an incredible amount of risk if you're going to be truthful about yourself, you could have. So I understand what you mean about like not wanting to say your opinion or kind of be hesitant about who you want to be or who you want to put out there as your real self. And there's a lot of performing, which online, you know, like that I think everyone does no matter what age, but do you really have Like, do these girls really have someone who really has their back and really knows about them, that they're cultivating, not just texting, but they're actually speaking to face to face? That is so hard. I'm not hearing that much of that happens at all. Like, even really well adjusted kids from really stable homes, they mm-hmm. don't have it either.
Right.
And so it makes you wonder. So it's almost like you need, with this whole generation of kids, any color kid too, and it's going to be harder for the kids who are in more difficult home situations, or have extra things that play into their lives as well. But these are kids you almost have to sit down and say, here's how you have a conversation. You're going to have to ask some questions. You're going to have to be interested in the answers. You're going to have to go back and forth. You're going to have to risk saying when something makes you feel uncomfortable instead of ghosting somebody. Right. Mm-hmm. And because these habits of like ghosting or I didn't get the text or something, they can't happen in real life. Right. Like it's mm-hmm. super awkward. So then there's all these avoidance techniques. And I don't remember that even 5 years ago happening. I didn't have a teenager 5 years ago, but it's, it really is different.
Yeah. Right. And there used to be that phrase, you know, agree to disagree. And I mean, you don't hear those phrases anymore either. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, where people, you know, a big thing growing up was always, how do you agree to disagree? How do you sit at the table with someone, you know, and have difficult conversations? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't hear that language among that generation at all.
Now. Yeah, it's almost like let's not. It's either kind of like a rant that you just sort of shout into the void, into the universe, and don't have any consequence for it, or it's like I'm terrified to tell somebody in real life, you know, it's the truth about me, or you know, maybe I'll get rejected, because there is real social consequences when you're talking to people face to face, and you can feel all squeamish about it, especially if you want to be accepted, right? So I'm thinking, like, even you know, your average kid, let alone the kid who has a lot of insecurities or has some kind of body issues, which is pretty much almost every teenager that I have ever known, you even in the best of circumstances, you have these kids who really don't have the same communication tools. And you probably find this out as you speak to them one-on-one about all these, just these obstacles to be able to talk to peers or teachers or in a way that maybe was easier before we had these handy tools of technology.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So, I mean, it presents a lot of extra problems to an age that's already a difficult age to get through.
Yeah, yeah. It's really true. I have to do a lot of kind of affirming that it is difficult, you know? So even though it's like, okay, you need to do this, you need to do that. And, you know, a good percentage of the session really is, you know, it's okay. Yeah. It sucks. Yeah. I don't even get it. I can't even begin to understand. You couldn't pay me to be your age, you know, like I've been that and just come at them with a level of empathy, at least trying to, initially, and knowing like, look, there's going to be a lot of mistakes, a lot of failures, you know, we'll talk how to get through it, but you'll have to learn your way through the failure that's going to happen continuously until you establish a new, you know, emotional rhythm.
Hmm. Now, since you deal with, you get to hear the stuff the parents probably don't get to hear.
Yeah.
I bet. What would you say to, what do you wish that parents knew about their kids that age?
You know, it's weird because I'm not a parent, you know, I have mm-hmm. a little sister or whatever, but you know, but I think it's hard for parents to not, you know, you want to protect, you know what I mean? So there's just automatically going to blur and bias things, you know? And there's nothing wrong with that, but that's an automatic mama bear, papa bear thing that happens. And so they'll only be able to hear so much because of that. And so it's not what I wish they knew about the kids, as much as I wish that they, would acknowledge that as a limitation and intentionally, bring their kids into spaces where they can have other types of mentoring relationships. You know, you kind of alluded to it in some of your comments recently. And I say all that to say just because they will need the village, right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of the parents, you know, are like, well, she's got me, you know, that come into the office. And yeah, they need counseling for a little bit, but she's got me. And I'm like, yeah, you are the source. I get it, you know. But there's some other things that, you know, because of how much you care and how protecting you are, mm-hmm. you know, that you won't be able to hear through just a completely unbiased, you know, ear, even though you really, really want to.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I don't want my sister to tell me everything. Don't tell me everything. I don't want to know. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, tell somebody else everything. Tell me, you know, there's but so much I'm going to be able to help her with. But in my heart, mm-hmm. you know, of course I want to help her with everything, but I can't mm-hmm. because I just can't.
Right.
You know, it's gonna like kill me. So reserve that for, you know, so I'll tell her, yeah, I think you need to, she's got my mom, she's got me, you know, and as far as like, you know, women, she's got my dad, you know, but as far as women in her life and then even my aunts, but I'm like, you need a therapist, you need a counselor, you know, or you need a mentor, go find a big sister too. You know, like you said, it's hard nowadays, you know, you can't really trust everybody, but I would love for parents to try to seek out more intentional spaces for their kids to get, you know, some more life guidance in some of the areas where they might have limitations. But fortunately, the parents of like kids that play sports, you know, they kind of get that a little bit more, you know, but growing up, I had that. I played basketball a lot. So I had my coach, you know, my coaches, you know, I had my mom, I had my pastor, I had my youth pastor, you know, there were various people in my life where I got different things from, that helped shape me. And like you said, this generation, for some reason, doesn't have that. That's not like an automatic thing that they get. You know.
Yeah, I definitely had like big sister types, camp counselors that were older than me, that maybe like 7 or 8 years older. And sometimes the moms of my friends I could talk to. But there's definitely some serious importance in having someone who isn't a family member you might be able to talk to. And also that your own parents are not threatened by that, that they don't think that's bad, that they just know that sometimes you need to talk to someone else and that.
Right.
That will help you. It's not like you're hiding right. everything. It's just that some things you need to talk to different people about. I think that it's just harder to come by. It seems like people are busier. I don't know if they're busier or just more occupied, but I think allowing that, like, I wonder if in our churches, if we had a more of an open door policy, like, hey, if you're not comfortable talking to me, talk to, you know, auntie so-and-so, you know, who are the older friend or the older,
right.
you know, person in the church who will come alongside you for a little while, and they won't, in confidence, they won't tell me about it either. And you can just know that more people have your back and you're not alone, and you don't have to tell, you know, you don't have to tell your peers something if you don't feel you can trust them or something like that. But it's true that they're holding all that inside, and then, you know, there's a lot more anxiety and stuff going on than there really needs to be.
Yeah. And, you know, the parents that come, they're at their wit's end, you know, a lot of stuff, majority of them. But I had one recently whose just daughter was like, yeah, I just need somebody to talk to. And her mom was like, and I bought her immediately. I didn't want to wait, you know, and I was like, good, I'm glad, you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
And they have a great relationship. That was the one thing that, like, it just, it was so great to watch, because the two of them, even watching them, you know, come in, I never met them before, but they had such a great rapport, and it seemed like they just were like best friends. And even her daughter was like, we're best friends, you know? And I'm like, it's so good that your mom, you know, wasn't threatened by the fact that you needed somebody else to talk to, mm-hmm. even though the two of you are best friends, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't a shot against her, and mm-hmm. she didn't take it personal. And she said, maybe she needs a little extra assistance. And And I just love that. And so I would love, to see a little bit more of that. But like you said, there's, I don't know where those, what that would look like in each, you know, in each individual family's life or kid's life is, it's going to be different. Everybody doesn't have those spaces. So.
Yeah. Right. Are there any other things you'd like to talk about or projects or upcoming things beyond the Becoming conference? Is there anything that you wanted to cover?
Yeah. So I wrote a book called in 2013 called The Misinterpreted Gospel of Singleness. And it's a cultural critique of myths surrounding singleness in the Christian community, which honestly is, I don't want to say it's back relevant again, because it seems to be a relevant topic across the board, but it was a major Twitter topic like a week or two ago, about, you know, singleness and how mainly women are made to feel like shamed or like they have a deadline. And that's the whole reason why I wrote the book. It had to do with the fact that there are all of these myths that I think are perpetuated, cultural myths, in the Christian community that are really mainly geared toward women, but it leaves people more insecure and just kind of choosing anyone. And I think it really is detrimental to marriages in the long run, because people wind up making decisions based off the fact that they feel like they have to rush or might as well, you know, so I can get whoever off my back, you know?
Right.
And then later on there, that reason was why they got married. And later on they have issues in their marriage and it becomes the devil's attack in the marriage. And I'm like, well, it kind of started like early, you know, before you guys got married. But that's what winds up happening. It winds up being this cycle. And so I talk a lot about those things, but just also how they had, affected me personally and how, a lot of people, single people, have to resist those myths, so that when they are dating and or, you know, praying or thinking about marriage of any sort, that it doesn't come with that cloud over it, you know, that it's a pure, you know, kind of decision that is completely spirit-led and not you know, led by these myths. So wrote that. And partly autobiographical, only because I put just my own experiences in it on purpose. And so I did that when I was at APU, and it can be, it's on Amazon.com right now. So you can either type in my name or you can type in the title of the book, The Misinterpreted Gospel of Singleness. And so, yeah, it's up there now. I think it's pretty cheap. It's like $10 or something like that. But it's still up there.
Yeah, that's a very good message. There's a lot of pressure. I've noticed a lot of pressure among teens and 20-year-olds, like as if you're not whole if you haven't been matched up. And it's very, very damaging and distracting. And what a terrible reason to get married. Like if you, I mean, I can't imagine. But there is a pressure out there, and it's if like, oh, you should. You know, what are you waiting for? It's like, what do you mean? Like, I'm a person first, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a terrible idea to get married thinking you're half of something anyway.
Yeah.
Because it really, if you don't come as a whole person to a marriage, you really are setting yourself up for a fall. So that sounds fantastic. And do you have plans to write any more? Are you?
People have been like, write a second singleness book. I'm like, I think I wrote everything I wanted to say. I never set out to be the singleness guru. I just had something to say, you know, I didn't want to make it into like this Carrie Bradshaw, you know, Sex in the City, like series. But I thought about it. There were a few times I was like, I'm going to write a sequel. And it takes a lot. You have to have a lot to say, you know, to write 40,000 words. So I just didn't have anything else to say. But if I do write again, because I have been so passionate about women's voices, I want to go in that direction. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, how to help women and girls come to voice, you know, and what that means and the hard work behind that. And so I think I would love to write around that topic and also try to highlight how different women have struggled to find their own voice or how they have discovered it. Because people ask me a lot about preaching and how, you know, I found my own voice in preaching, you know. And actually, like, it's kind of like I had to find my way back to my voice in preaching. I was so busy trying to sound like everybody else that I had to find my way back to, but this is how I sound, you know. But anyway, I something around women and women's voices and girls' voices, because it's just such a topic that's heavy on my heart. That's, if I write again, I think I can do 40,000 words with that. So,
okay, you've tantalized me. Now you have to write it, because that's excellent, because there is a kind of, I guess you could say, silence that happens when you don't know what to do. You know, you should step into something, mm-hmm. but what and how, and, you know, how do you get there? And, sharing our stories, I guess, is one way to do it. And also, signal boosting for people who aren't heard enough yet, is, you know, whether that's a young girl because she's young, or someone who's on the margins or something like that. Mm-hmm. It, I think, happens together, especially for women who are really might be discounted just because they're women. Yeah. But you're so fun to talk to. I guess I should just ask you, where are some places that people can find you to find out more about your work, and maybe look at your short films that you've done as well?
Yeah. So I have a website that has everything. I call it a smorgasbord of anything that I've done.
of goodness.
Yeah. So that's ChristyLaurenAdams.com. And my name is spelled K-H-R-I-S-T-I. So a lot of people don't really know that. But my website is ChristyLaurenAdams.com. And on it, I have some of my older articles, none of my recent ones. I have to update it, but some articles that I've written. My short films are up there. They're on YouTube, but they're up there as well. Mm-hmm. Some clips of sermons, some full sermons are up there. Contact information, because I do, some people do reach out on my site, for various reasons, whether they want advice for something, or they're in need of a speaker for their university or their conference or service or whatever. So all of it's up there. But socially, I am not on Facebook, and I feel really good about that. have not been on Facebook. I got off Facebook in like 2011 after this horrible breakup, and never got back on. But and I'm glad I didn't, because now I'm not on for a bunch of different reasons. I just don't want to walk into a JCPenney and then all of a sudden it show up on my like ad feed. It's just weird. But anyway, so I'm not on Facebook, but I am on Twitter. So Christy Lauren, at Christy Lauren, is my Twitter. And then my Instagram is at Christy Lauren as well. My Instagram is private, but I mean, you know, I usually accept anybody. But Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, you can just find me on my regular name, and my website.
That's great. I'll put those links in the show notes too, for anybody who wants to check those out later. And I hope you'll come back on at some point.
Yeah, I would love to.
It'd be fun. There's so much to talk about. Like, again, I was like looking at all this stuff. I'm like, what? Where do we start? This is just the intro. Intro to Christy Show. But yeah, it's been a blessing to speak with you, and thank you for all your work with the young women that are coming up. I know that it's the trenches, really, this kind of work, because it's unsung work, and it's hard, and it takes something out of you to do it. But it is really you're building the future of and the kind of people who will be leading us, you know, towards something tomorrow. And I think it's just one of those things where if we all care about the future in that way, we all have to take our part and lead someone along and shepherd them like that and invest in their lives. I think that what you're doing is just one of those invaluable things. So I thank you for that.
Thank you.
So, let's see. And do you have any final words of wisdom?
There was this, phrase on This Is Us that Randall, played by Sterling Brown, said to his brother, Kevin. And, Kevin had just gotten out of rehab and was trying to make amends with everyone. And Randall said to Kevin, you know, we all got our stuff. And it just stuck with me all week. I mean, everything with This Is Us sticks with me all week. So I'm going to be dramatic and say that. But that phrase stuck with me all week because I'm like you said earlier, it was simple, right? It's a simple phrase, but it's so true. And it was great because he kind of let Kevin off the, he still held Kevin accountable. But Kevin was kind of freed in that moment. That was what forgiveness was, I think. And so I talked on Sunday about how, you know, we all got our stuff. I used the example of the woman who was caught in adultery, and the religious leaders brought her before Jesus, and Jesus, you know, wrote down in the sand and then said, whoever is without sin, you know, let them cast the first stone. And so I was saying, you know, the thing that I took away from that passage, you know, regardless of, you know, the debate over what Jesus wrote in the ground or, you know, who the woman was it Mary Magdalene, you know, regardless of whatever debates there are around that particular passage, including the debate over whether or not it should be included in the manuscript. What I got out of it was we all got our stuff. You know what I mean? And that's basically, I think, you know, the 2018 interpretation of it. And if, you know, if we keep that mentality, then we will be a little bit more gracious with our forgiveness, with our thankfulness, our gratitude. And I think we'll also be a lot more understanding, you know, when it comes to letting people off the hook for their offenses. And I said, you know, it's not that you don't, like I said, it's not that you don't hold people accountable, but it's that you have a perspective in mind that we're all in this together, that not one person is above another, and we're all learning and growing and evolving, and we all fail miserably. And I was saying, you know, online, it's so easy to look at pictures and posts and people's lives and think, you know, everybody's got it together, but that's not true. There's stuff behind those photos. There's stuff behind the posts. Everybody has it. It does not matter what your background is. We all have our stuff. And we just need to be reminded of that from time to time, because we live in a world that's about facades. You know, as wonderful as it is to have access to communication online, it's about putting up facades, you know, television, you know, acting, performance, facades, and now church culture, you know, has kind of gotten to that performance-based facade type culture. So in the midst of all that, we need these constant reminders that not everyone is all right, you know, not everyone has it together. And if we kind of keep that mentality, then we will be a little less judgmental and a lot more grace-giving.
You're right. And also, if we're feeling ashamed about something and that we can't show our true selves, or we can't admit we were wrong or show anybody that we've ever screwed up, we can realize that nobody's perfect, and that even if that person isn't showing where they've failed, they're just hiding it really well. And that we all have our own stuff, so we can admit, maybe be the first one to admit that we've screwed up, and know that that's going to be the same for the other person too. That's really important to keep us, like, not just humble, but like real. And are we approachable? Are we real? Or do people think that we're too good that they can't approach us? It's an excellent point. And who knows? Who knew we would learn it on TV?
Yeah, right? I love that show.
I can't watch it. My sister was like, have you watched This Is Us? We just cry every episode. I said, I don't want to cry when I watch TV. I want to escape. Yeah, I just wish God's blessing on you, and especially as you prepare for the Becoming Conference, that the doors will just open up for you, and you will feel richly blessed as you plan.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned, or a book, or a website, that's what show notes are for. Patreon is like Patron, with an E, patreon.com/sparkmymuse. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.